Hello, I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. Well, I relented. After hearing so much about the Netflix series The Crown, I finally, at the urge of my lovely wife, tuned into season one just a few weeks ago. And boom, I was hooked. My main reasons for passing on it before were, one, I really try to regulate my TV watching, not wanting to dedicate too much time to it, and two, I've just never had much interest in England's royals. I've always been confused and amused about how much the House of Windsor has captured the attention and fascination of my fellow countrymen. I mean, didn't we fight a war to be rid of royal dominion? And we haven't even followed Canada's example of having a sort of distant cousins relationship with them. And yet, the sovereign and her brood still seem to hold sway over us, though we haven't been subjects of the crown for over 200 years. But nonetheless, the series The Crown is a masterful work, weaving history and fiction together in a remarkably compelling tale. If you've been a listener for any length of time, you know that one thing we really enjoy here is exploring the sacred when it is embedded in the mundane. One of our earliest programs was on the way religion was offered in The Simpsons. So I've been paying attention to how religion is also portrayed in The Crown. As you might know, the reigning sovereign is not only the head of state, but the titular head of the Church of England. So I thought I'd invite someone who knows a bit more than I do to discuss the subject of the series. So with us here today is Father Christian Brocato, who is a priest in the Anglican Communion here in the United States. That is, he is Episcopalian. A little bit about Father Brocato. He is originally from Helena, Arkansas, and his education consists of time spent at the University of Cincinnati, University of Minnesota, and the Aquinas Institute of Theology in St. Louis. And currently, he is the rector of St. Mark's Episcopal Church in downtown Grand Rapids. So we welcome to Common Threads, Christian Brocato. Hello, Christian.
Hello, Fred, and thanks for having me on.
Certainly. I appreciate that. When I was thinking of people who might be someone to speak on this, you were the first person that came to mind, and something told me you were a fan as well. So that's why I reached out, and you indicated immediately that you're a fan of The Crown. So let's talk about the Anglican Communion right off, so we understand exactly what we're dealing with. So you are Episcopalian. You are part of what is called the Anglican Communion. So first, let's go way back. And, you know, it's interesting. The very first time I remember is probably in high school, maybe college, but probably high school, where I heard of the Church of England. It was explained to me by a Catholic. And tell me if you are familiar with this real shorthand version of the so-called history of the Anglican Church. And that is that King Henry was a Catholic. Henry VIII, he was a Catholic. He wanted a divorce. The Catholic Church wouldn't let him have a divorce, so he said, to heck with you guys, I'll just start my own church. So he starts the Church of England, which is similar to Catholicism, except he's the head and he gets to divorce and dispatch as many wives as he wants to. I suspect I'm missing something in that history.
And, you know,
have you heard that before?
It is the common notion among lots and lots of people. However, let's just go back a little bit to the worldwide Anglican Communion and to address that kind of first. But the communion itself is the third largest Christian communion in the world, and with over 85 million members in many, many different countries. You know, it's taken a while for that to develop, but the kind of the misnomer is that Henry did found the Church of England, but it's simply not true. Henry, as you stated, was Catholic, Roman Catholic, and in many ways lived and died a practicing Catholic. Apparently, his prayer book was in Latin, and he attended services, Mass in Latin. But when he broke with Rome, and just prior to his breaking with Rome, he had been given the great title of Defender of the Faith in England. So he was very much attached to Rome and certainly to the papacy. Yes, it is true that when he wanted to get a divorce, because the Roman Church doesn't allow divorce, he did break with Rome. But the history of the Church of England dates back all the way to at least the end of the first century or the second century, with the Celtic tradition, which eventually evolved into what we would call today the Church of England. In addition, Augustine of Canterbury was sent from Rome, from the Pope in Rome, in the late 500s, to officially have a residential presence, if you will, in the British Isles. So that's late 500s. So that basically means that the Church of England was well established even by that time. So when Henry comes along and cuts ties with Rome, the Church of England was well established. So he didn't found the Church of England, nor did he found the Anglican tradition. One thing that's pretty fascinating is that the word Anglican itself can actually be traced back to the Magna Carta in the year 1215, where it talks about the Anglican Church shall be free, and Anglicana. And it really isn't until the 19th century that word Anglican really came into widespread use. And that was when the communion was being formed in the 19th century with all of these different disparate churches all around the world, by the way, of which the Episcopal Church is just one major part of the Anglican communion.
So is there, when I think of Anglicans, I think of Anglicans who are in England or in one of the dominions. People actually refer to themselves as Anglicans. And I also think of Episcopalians if I'm thinking of people in America. What are some of the other denominations that are in communion with the Anglican Church?
Well, the Evangelical Lutheran Church is now very much in communion. That happened a number of years ago now, but it was basically determined that there weren't enough differences between the two traditions, although there certainly are some subtle differences. There's significant dialogue actually with the United Presbyterian Church. I mean, not the Presbyterian, the Methodist Church, sorry. Because of again, many similarities. But the truth is, in some ways, the Anglican Church, the Episcopal Church, the Anglican Church, which are really the same thing, it is far more Roman Catholic and adheres more to Roman Catholic kinds of polity and even theology in many ways than it does with the more Protestant tradition. So in the 16th century, and certainly into the 17th century, the hierarchy, the church in England as it was, began to talk about itself in terms of the middle way, and that is embracing many Roman Catholic practices, theology, the historical episcopate, the creeds, and all of these things that date back to the earliest church, including the early church fathers. So in many ways, the Episcopal Church, the Anglican Church, is more like the Roman Catholic Church than it would be more like traditional Protestant denominations.
Yeah, I've actually been in conversations where people did not really like the designation of Protestant placed upon people who were Episcopalian.
Right, yeah, and that's true. In fact, I traditionally don't refer to us We were when the Episcopal Church was founded after the Revolutionary War, the official title did have Protestant in it. It was a number of years ago now that the word Protestant was actually was abandoned, if you will. A much more apt word, I think, is Reformed. I mean, the idea, even with Martin Luther in the early 1500s, was to reform the church from within the church, the Roman church, and not to establish a new denomination. And the same thing I would assume in the early 1500s with the after Henry broke, you know, Cranmer and friends, you know, were really crafting not so much a completely new tradition, but a tradition based on what had gone before. A really significant thing, however, for the Episcopal Church, and certainly for Luther and the Lutheran tradition, is the vernacular. So the idea, you know, widespread in the 1400s and into the 1500s was the need for people to worship in their own native languages, and Rome would have no part of that. I mean that. It, as you may know, I mean, it wasn't really until the Second Vatican Council in the 1960s that Latin was abandoned and replaced by the vernacular throughout the world. So there are many differences, but I think there are many similarities. I teach a class here every year called the Inquirers class, and we spend a great deal of time talking about the similarities and the differences between the Anglican tradition of the Episcopal Church and that of the Roman Church. So there are many, many similarities. The sacramental life, bishops, priests, archbishops, and hierarchical kinds of things, canons, canon law, things like that, which are really very different than some of our more Protestant or Reformed brothers and sisters.
You know, what's interesting, too, is if you took a Roman Catholic, garden variety, Roman Catholic, and you sent him to an Episcopal communion service, I would and then the next Sunday, you sent him to a Catholic church of the Eastern Rite, such as Ukrainian Catholic or Romanian Catholic, I would suspect that that person, once he experienced both liturgies, would feel much more comfortable and at home in your Episcopalian service as opposed to an Eastern Rite service, which, although they are in communion with Rome, their liturgies are very much like Eastern Orthodox.
Correct, yeah. In fact, most Roman Catholics who visit St. Mark's will say to me, and like in the receiving line, "Wow, it just felt the same to me." And indeed, the structure of the liturgy is essentially the same. You know, there's an opening rite, there's the liturgy of the word, there's the communion liturgy or the liturgy of the Holy Eucharist, there's the reception of the sacrament, bread and wine, that we both refer to as the body and blood of Jesus, or the body and blood of Christ, and the dismissal. So the structure of the liturgy looks very, very, very similar, and people find themselves very comfortable. But you're right. I mean, then going to Romanian or some other kind of Orthodox or Eastern Rite is vastly different. I mean, the ceremony itself, the liturgy itself, is also very different. There's certainly a liturgy of the Word. There's certainly a liturgy of the Eucharist. But the way that plays out in reality is radically different than what we would experience either in the Roman tradition, the Roman Catholic Mass, or in the Episcopal tradition, which, by the way, in our prayer book, we are free to also call it a Mass. So, you're right. People would feel far more comfortable here than they would if they were at a Greek Orthodox church or any of the Eastern Rite churches.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Common Threads here on WGVU. My name is Fred Stella, and with me today is Father Christian Brocato from St. Mark's Episcopal Church in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and we are talking about the history of the Anglican Communion and how it is reflected in the Netflix series The Crown. So, question. Before I ask that question, something else just popped into my head that I was thinking a few minutes ago. the fact that we're talking about the split between Rome and London, it happened around the same general time as the Protestant Reformation. I'm curious if there was dialogue amongst those people from the Church of England, Calvin or his acolytes, and Luther and his following. Is there any shared history there, or did happen to a coincidence? Oh, you're doing this. Oh, we're doing the same thing.
Yeah, it seems that Luther was a little bit ahead of other people, but there are actually letters back and forth from Cranmer and others in England writing to and from Luther. So I oftentimes, when I teach this class called In Corus class, I oftentimes think of this as like there was reform in the drinking water, and it wasn't just between those two countries. There were many other countries, Switzerland and Bohemia, all kinds of different places had found themselves really at odds with what was going on in the Christian tradition, which of course was the Roman Catholic tradition. And so there was a concerted movement, and there was dialogue between Luther and some of the reformers in England in the early 1500s.
So now let's get into the series that we're here to talk about, the Crown. So you are American. You are not a monarchist. Otherwise, you probably wouldn't be American. And yet, Queen Elizabeth II is considered the head of the Anglican Church. What sort of relationship does an American Episcopalian have with the sovereign of England?
Well, let's back up just a little bit and say, just do a little bit of a distinguishing characteristic, and that is, I think the Queen would think of herself as the titular head of the Church of England. She probably would not think of herself as the titular head of the Anglican Communion. And so that would indicate that all of these churches throughout some 85 different churches around the world, certainly have honor and respect the Queen, but really don't really look to her as the titular head of those individual churches. So we certainly don't do that. I'm fascinated by the revolution, because at the time of the revolution, of course, the Anglican Church, the Church of England, was really very strong in the United States. And really, it was at Christ Church, Philadelphia. It's either in 1776 or 1777 that the actual break with the Church of England actually happened. And in one of their display cases in their parish hall is the actual writing, the actual document of those who signed this document actually breaking with the Church of England. The challenge then for the church here in the United States was that all of the bishops had come from England. And so in order to maintain that apostolic succession, which is very, very important to us in the Episcopal Church, there was a whole process that anybody that wanted to be ordained as a bishop had to go through. So that's a whole other story. So I personally have great affection for the monarchy, the Queen, and the history of that whole tradition, though I don't think of her as the head of my church.
And so what relationship do you have with the Archbishop of Canterbury?
The Archbishop of Canterbury is the Episcopal Church's archbishop. So the Archbishop of Canterbury is essentially the titular head of the entire communion, the entire world, although there are other archbishops. Case in point, the Archbishop of York, in some ways, is a very powerful archbishop. But Archbishop of Canterbury is the head of the entire Anglican communion, and he is our archbishop. So in our prayers of the people, every Sunday morning, we pray for Justin, Archbishop of Canterbury. Now, he doesn't exercise the same kind of ecclesiastical authority that a Roman Catholic archbishop does, nor do our bishops. It's a very different kind of polity, but all of another distinguishing characteristic is that that I, as the priest of this parish, was elected by the search committee. We elect our bishops, and the Archbishop of Canterbury goes through a kind of electoral kind of process, a long, lengthy process, but he is actually appointed, finally appointed, by the Queen of England. So that's one of her major roles in terms of her oversight of the Church of England, is to make the final appointment of the Archbishop of Canterbury, which is a big deal, and that's historically a big deal.
And do you know, is that selection a formality, or is it genuine? Because so much what the Queen does is a formality. Somebody says, "Oh, here, you're doing this today," and she does it.
Well, I think it's probably a formality that's also very serious, you know, because it's historical and it goes back, you know, many centuries. And she takes that very seriously. If you watched the consecration of the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin, or his predecessors, I mean, it's an amazing event. And taken very, very seriously. And because the Archbishop of Canterbury, I mean, like all bishops in the Anglican tradition, you know, adhere to the apostolic succession, basically meaning to the apostles. So she is actually consecrating and making present an archbishop that we do very much believe is in communion, if you will, with the first apostles, which is called the apostolic succession.
So, shorthand answer, how do you think the Anglican tradition and religion in general is portrayed in the series The Crown? Do you think that they give it the import that it deserves?
You know, I'm in the middle of the fourth season, and it is absolutely fascinating. And as we know, and as the British government has tried to get the producers to say, you know, that some of these things are fact and some of these things are dramatic intentions, et cetera, et cetera. I don't think the Church of England. I don't think there's a whole lot about the Church of England in the series. It seems much more kind of focusing on individual persons and individual situations, many of which are historically documented. Whether or not they are as the series actually portrays them may be a different story. But I think that There is less about the Church of England in The Crown than actually about what it means for Elizabeth to be the monarch.
Well, it's true that there are many episodes where religion isn't brought up at all, but there are a few where it is somewhat central. So, for instance, let's talk about the episode, I forget which season, where her sister Margaret, she wants to marry a divorced man, Peter Townsend, not the Peter Townsend we all love and know, who wrote Won't Get Fooled Again, but another Peter Townsend, who, again, is divorced. And so Elizabeth meets with the heads of the Anglican Church, and they are quite hard and fast that this cannot happen in the church. So I'm curious. Let's we only have a few minutes here. We have 3 minutes. So if you can answer this in 3 minutes, I'd appreciate that very much, Christian.
The Anglican Church, I can talk probably more to the Episcopal Church, but, you know, does not look lightly on divorce, very much like our Roman Catholic counterparts. However, In our Book of Common Prayer, by the way, every church in the Anglican Communion, one of the things that unites us is that we have this Book of Common Prayer, which has all of our prayer rites and all of those kinds of things, but also has the teachings and the dogmas and, you know, the things that we adhere to, the doctrines, et cetera, et cetera. The Episcopal Church does allow divorce, but only if it's like the last resort. So my guess is because the monarchy is the monarchy, that they may actually be held to a different standard. You know, that divorce would be historically much harder and much difficult to actually achieve or get, if you will, than for the regular citizen. You know. In part because of what it represents.
And yet, Henry was able to get a divorce.
Henry? Yes, several.
Yes.
Several.
Maybe he used them all up.
Right. Well, and remember, too, I mean, when you probably know this, that in the early, I mean, when by the time Henry died, you know, the church had become certainly more reformed or after Henry's death than Henry would have experienced it. But then when Mary came back onto the throne, then it became Roman Catholic again. So the church in the 1500s and into the 1600s really kind of went back and forth. They're either going to be more Roman Catholic or they're going to be more Protestant or Reformed, back and forth.
Got it.
And divorce is a big part of that, because in the Roman Church, divorce is really not allowed. It is possible, certainly, but, you know, like in our tradition, if you were to get divorced, would never be denied the sacrament in the Episcopal Church.
Well, listen, Christian, we are out of time for this session of Common Threads, but more questions to ask about the Crown and the Anglican Communion, the Episcopal Church, so I'd love it if you'd be able to join us next week.
I'd be happy to do that. Thanks so much, Fred.
You're listening to Common Threads here on WGVU. My name is Fred Stella, and with me today, Father Christian Brocato. We're talking about, as I just mentioned, the Anglican Communion, the Episcopal Church, and the TV series The Crown. Please join us again here on WGVU.